Welcome to the Leadership Journey Podcast. This is the first episode of the podcast in 2019, and let me take the opportunity to wish you a happy new year. My name is Alan Wilson, and I am your host. Each week on the podcast, I'll be chatting to various Christian leaders, discussing some of the things that have contributed to the story of their leadership, and at the same time encouraging you to reflect on your own leadership journey. You can subscribe to the podcast for free on iTunes or on Castbox. Just look for the Leadership Journey Podcast, and it would be great if you were able to take a moment to leave us a review. I'll introduce this week's guest in a moment, but first I'd like to tell you about an event for leaders that's coming up in just under 2 weeks' time. It's a two-day retreat organised by Roz Sterling of Cleopas Ministries, and it's designed particularly for church and ministry leaders and their spouses. It's taking place at Dromalis in Larne, and it starts on Monday the 21st of January and runs through Tuesday the 22nd of January. I'll be speaking on the Monday evening and on the Tuesday, leading some reflections on the theme of the leadership journey through the lens of the story of Moses. There's a website, www.cleopas.net, where you can find details of how to register, and you will need to register by the 16th of January. Roz will be one of the guests on the podcast over the next few weeks. Meantime, to get back to today's episode, my guest over the next 3 weeks is Russell Burney. Russell is a retired Presbyterian minister. In fact, he's a former moderator of the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. During his years of active ministry, he served in several congregations, including in Newry and in Ballymena, where he was minister of High Kirk for over 20 years. Enjoy the podcast. Russell, you are very welcome on the Leadership Journey podcast. It's great to have you, and thank you for giving the time to talk to me. Give us your full title. Are you the Reverend Doctor? In fact, are you the Reverend Doctor Doctor?
Yes, I suppose technically, but you know, you're touching on it's a touchy subject, because in the terms of ministry and leadership, there is no room for status and no room for titles.
Okay.
And really no room for hard and fast institutions, all of which I either belong to or have attached to me. Very reverent.
Very reverent.
I whisper that. And yeah. doctor, but you ignore that.
Well, one of the doctorates you did actually, I was going to say one of them you did earn and you had to work for it. Well, you had to work for them both, but different ways.
Yes.
So one is a Doctor of Ministry degree, and the other is because you're a former moderator of
the
Presbyterian Church.
Well, the Doctor of Ministry degree was a seminal thing for me. It was at a particular point in my ministry when I really felt the need for basically renewal. Mm-hmm. And I took advice from some wise men, and they recommended to me that I should consider going to Gordon Conwell rather than Fuller or Westminster in the States, because the D-Min wasn't being offered here at the time.
Yeah.
So I went to Gordon Conwell.
Okay, well, listen, we'll come back to that because that will, you know, we'll sort of try to put down a little bit of background, a little bit of context, and come back, because I think that's an important theme for people who are in leadership and ministry. You know, at that sort of middle stage, finding ways of renewal, I think that's very important. But let's go back to the beginning. You're a Fermanagh man?
I am.
Tell us a little bit about growing up in Fermanagh.
Well, it's a very pleasant experience, a lovely county. You wouldn't have bought a car from a Fermanagh man because the roads were so bad. But now they've improved greatly and it's become a very popular destination for weekenders and for holidaymakers and for caravanners and all sorts of things. And we did live in the slow lane down Fermanagh. We were very much in the shadow of the townie, and we probably had inferiority complexes, particularly the Presbyterians, because we were a rare species down there. There were very few of us.
Right, what was the religious landscape like down there?
The religious landscape was, in Protestantism, it would have been Church of Ireland, predominantly Church of Ireland, and then followed by Methodists. And the few Presbyterians, there were 27 families in our congregation, and that never varied. I'm sure if we looked up statistics today, Listener's Quay Presbyterian Church would still have 27 families. We had very few people coming in. If there were people coming in and we got word of it, we would be meeting the bus to help carry their cases into their house. And then there were the even more fringe people, the brethren. I don't know how many halls there would have been. And the Baptist church began to come in. I'm not sure how things are
many.
Now. There aren't many. So it is really outback country, but a wonderful county and a wonderful place in which to grow up. It had its disadvantages. Maybe that will come out sometime in the podcast. But on the whole, I wouldn't have swapped it for anything.
Great. And what about church then? Your family was part of the Presbyterian church?
Yeah, we were very near the chapel. We were very near the church. We were, in fact, next door to it. So therefore, we were never first in. Got the extra wee sleep, and then we slipped into church.
Right, but if you'd been out gardening instead of being at morning worship, you'd have been noticed.
Correct. Oh yes. Well, nobody gardened in those days.
No.
Absolutely.
Right.
Every clothesline was bare. There were no clothes hanging on it, and you were there. That's one of the big changes now, of course. There's no embarrassment if you have your clothesline full and you're gardening and doing all the things that you could. So, there was no excuse for that.
And what was that like then, growing up in that sort of church environment? Was it...
We only met once in the week, and that wasn't church. It was a part of a union. There were three congregations, McGuire's Bridge and Newtown Butler. And now, I think Lisbelow has added to that. And that union of congregations meant that the poor minister really had no time for midweek activities.
Right.
Well, in fact, what can you do with 27 families, many of whom would not have had children? So it was a small cause, but it was a nice environment to worship in as well as to live in.
Did you come to faith early on during that time, or was that something that came a little bit later?
I came to faith not within the congregation, but at the age of 15 there was a mission, a gospel campaign in a disused wood products factory. A time of great excitement. It was run really by an international group, interdenominational group, and with the smell of the sawdust is still in my nose.
It was the sawdust trail, as they say.
Absolutely. Yeah. And also, it coincided with Billy Graham coming over for his first campaign. So we hadn't Billy Graham, but we had the next best thing. We had a man called Ken Iverson, whom I believe was of a Pentecostal background, but none of us knew what that meant in those days. And went along there. And in fact, that was, I would say, was the first real challenge and I responded to the gospel message that was proclaimed at that particular time. And that was the start, really, of my Christian journey. And I feel that everything preceding that, as far as church life was concerned, was good for me. I don't look back and think it was second class in any way. It was lovely. I was taught about Jesus. I knew about him, and but I'd never been challenged, and this was the first time that happened.
After that, how straight was the line of progress, you know, eventually into the ministry?
Totally erratic.
Oh, right. Okay.
Absolutely.
Well, talk to us a bit about that.
Well, I think one of the failures of that particular mission and campaign, while it provided great excitement and new friends and a new experience in many respects, as far as the technical end of it was concerned, there was no follow-up. Absolutely none. And I would have wanted to say in the podcast regarding those early days that I would have yearned now in retrospect for someone to have walked with me along the way. But anything counselling was usually of a negative. Even at 15, I was very keen table tennis player, and I would have gone maybe all round the place playing in junior tournaments and whatnot. And I remember going to a meeting, being brought to a meeting one night, and as I was preparing to get out of the car, someone turned to me, and now that you're a Christian, Russell, you will be giving up the table tennis, won't you?
Mm.
Now, that was the kind of censoriousness that there was about. Mm. And it was disappointing.
Did you give up the table tennis?
I did not.
Oh,
I continued to play.
Yeah.
And perhaps that also, it was important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I continued to play. But it was difficult because I was brought to meetings.
Mm-hmm.
But then the days came when the car didn't come and I was left there and found my way in other directions, that a mentor or someone who had really taken an interest could have helped me to avoid.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what then happened? Did you begin then to drift away, really?
Yes, I did. I did. And then at the age of 19, I went to Canada.
Hmm. Why did you go to Canada?
I went to Canada on a working holiday.
Mm-hmm.
It was so important in Fermanagh that it appeared in the Impartial Reporter newspaper.
The fact that you'd gone to Canada.
The fact that the son of John and Ina Burney had gone to Canada on a working holiday was in the news. And
Your family were local business people?
They were. Yeah. We had a general merchant's store and were grounded in Lisnaski, and that was our home. And I'm glad that the house is still there, even though the business is not in our hands now. So I went off to Canada. But in the background, there was always the notion of a Jonah reason for going to Canada, which was to get away from God.
So there was... Were you aware of that? Or was it
yes, I was aware of that.
Even if it was in the background, you were consciously aware of
I
that?
I was conscious. It was a conscious decision.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was... playing two games here, in a sense, you know, I was on the religious court and I was on the secular court, and I really was of split personality as far as that was concerned, and I didn't want that to last any longer, so I went off, and it worked in a sense because I made the break, and when I came home, it was quite obvious that I wouldn't be going to very many meetings.
Yeah.
And I started maybe 2 years in the wilderness from that period on.
Okay, two years in the wilderness, and were you sort of cut yourself off from God?
I did. Quite deliberately. Because I remember coming home and another story leading up to my recommitment. The moderator of the General Assembly, a godly man called John Davey, who had been a missionary in India for many, many years and had been chosen as moderator, which was a tremendous thing for our church to do, because most of Presbyterians, apart from praying for him, maybe hadn't met the man. But when he came home, he was voted and nominated and passed as moderator, and he came. And my mother, I remember I was in bed, and my mother came out and says, "You're going to church today, Russell?" I said, "No, I'm not." And she said, "Well, look, we need everybody to be there just to fill the pews. Would you not come?" And because my mother was my mother and because I loved her dearly, I went. And that was really the start of me coming back to the Lord.
Do you remember what he preached about?
Oh, not a word. And not a word. Later years, I wrote to him and told him the thing, and he was greatly encouraged by that. And he sent me a book of children's addresses, which it did dip into to help along the way, as we need now and again.
Yeah.
But he was just a lovely man. And whatever he spoke about just hit me.
Mm-hmm.
And my recommitment was really a story of three Sundays, which I'll not go into.
No, tell us about the three Sundays.
Well, I suppose...
We have time, we're not going anywhere.
Okay, in
people
traditional terms, which would suit you, Alan, I came under conviction.
Well, God was after you.
No, God was after me, the hound of heaven. And they... became very unsettled. But the following Sunday, I went out with my friends, my new friends, and we, my new friends of over the years, and we went to Bundoran.
Mm-hmm.
They went into a pub, and they had to get, as they described it, oiled before proceeding to the next stage of the evening, which was a dance in the local hall. I didn't go into the pub, I never did. I sat outside, it was a lovely, balmy summer evening, and one of my friends came up to me and he said, he was quite intoxicated, and he said, "Russell," he says, "we'll have to try and get you back on the straight and narrow." And that hit me like a sledgehammer between the eyes. And I went home. The process continued, unknown to me, of being unsettled and disturbed in my own heart and in my own spirit. The next Sunday, we went to Dublin. And it was the day of the All-Ireland final. And we went to, I think it was called the Metropole, the hotel, and there was a dance. And during the dance, a girl came over and took me out for a lady's choice. And as we danced, she said to me, "What are you doing in Dublin?" I said, "Oh, I'm down for the final." I wasn't down for the final at all. And she said, Imagine if we're man and man, and a listener, ski man at that, being down for the final. Who are you supporting?" I said, "Down." Well, I was hesitant and shaky because suddenly it came up to me, what if my father and mother knew that I was in Dublin at a dance on a Sunday night, totally out of their desire for me as a son? And that really hit me. That's the third Sunday, Alan. And the next day, on the Monday, I received an invitation to go to a birthday party of the CSSM in Port Ballantrae, at which I once had been a worker. And this was just too much for me. I just dissolved. And my dad knew there was something wrong. And he says, "What is wrong, Russell?" And I said, "Dad, I'm just having a sticky wicket at the moment." And well, he said, "Go, you needn't take the day off." So I left the shop where I was working, and really for 2 days came under tremendous conviction of sin. And at the my dad comes into it again, and the story came up, and he said, "What is wrong?" And I said, "Dad, look, I realise things are not as they should be in my life. And I've got an invitation to go to something in Port Ballantrae." He says, "Well, go on, son. You go on to that." Now, Dad didn't make any profession. Of course, a good man, an upright man in every sense of the word. And he says, "Well, you just go on up there, lad, and come back a different fellow." Now, imagine coming from those quarters. Yeah. I had just... They had helped me purchase it. I had a new Mini. Nothing to stop me. And I put up whatever I needed and I went up and I stayed in CSSM House. And it was spoke to a friend of mine from later became a Church of Ireland minister, Ian MacDonald. And Ian, in the early hours of the morning, pointed me right back and at least helped me find the way back. And that was really the start of that.
So your whole conversion, to put it like this, is it's a two-stage thing.
Absolutely.
Really, it's the initial commitment, the drift away, and then this time it stuck, if we can use that language.
Well, I think that's right. I'm glad you did use that, because it's difficult to say when were you converted. You know, I know there's some folk who during childhood, you know, my late wife would have said at the eight-year-old, she became a Christian when she said yes to Jesus, you know, having been brought up in a Christian home, and just a lovely confirmation of covenantal theology in a sense. But with me, it started in that, and I will never deny it, in the wood products building. It proceeded, I remember another stage, with a dear man called Tommy Anderson up in a wee hall in Listener Ski. But the third one was the one when I really underlined mm-hmm. in a very deliberate mm-hmm. way that early commitment. Because I knew something about mm-hmm. it then.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't the first time. Yeah. It was like the seed that was sown mm-hmm. and it fell on rocky ground mm-hmm. and it didn't produce mm-hmm. what it should have produced. Mm-hmm. But by the time I had 6 years to think about
yes.
it, and, through very different stages of my life, and some people say, you know, that once you have got to know Christ, once you've come to know Christ, it's very difficult to get away from him.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I think that was true in my mm-hmm. my case.
Well, was there a massive change in your life then? At that point?
Yeah, there was a massive change.
How would you describe that?
Well, it was transformation. Mm-hmm. Or whatever the adjective is out of that word.
Stick an A-L on the end of it.
Okay, you do that, Alan, and you pronounce it then.
Transformational.
Brilliant.
I'm paid to know that.
That was it. It coloured my whole life from there. I just changed completely, and much to the horror of my friends, mm-hmm. My old friends, and much to their confusion, mm-hmm. many of them remained friends, although I wasn't in touch with them. They would still talk to me quite freely and openly mm-hmm. today.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the ways that people would have discerned that change?
Well, within myself, first of all.
Not Sunday night dancing and
dancing. Oh, no. I almost felt a wee bit awkward about that anyway. Anyway, we'll drop the dancing end of it, and we'll talk. Well, you know, just the new, completely new interests, a new desire to make up for the years that the locust has eaten, as the scriptures say. Mm-hmm. Although, as I hope it'll come out in our discussion, those years weren't wasted in terms of leadership, because mm-hmm. I followed up a lot of new interests. I developed as a youth, and then came into manhood with some things which in later years stood me in good stead.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I was the front man in our business.
Mm-hmm.
So I was talking to people and was able to talk to them on along different lines. And my whole desire for the rest of my life changed. I no longer saw myself really staying in business life,
mm-hmm.
But I wanted to serve God. That was the mm-hmm. thing. I really did want to serve God.
Mm-hmm.
And to that end, a young Methodist minister, not a minister, he was a circuit evangelist, mm-hmm. came to Liston Skee, and he opened an account in our shop. And he came and was there on a regular basis. And I got to know him. We were quite unlike each other. He was an introvert. I was more an extrovert. And but he was. I said, you know, I would love to learn Greek.
Greek.
Right. And he had been.
What put that into your head?
I don't know. I always thought I went to a technical school mm-hmm. where I didn't have an opportunity to do languages.
Mm-hmm.
And I did things that I hated doing.
Mm-hmm.
Woodwork, metalwork, mechanical drawing. I never, ever could have existed in that kind of environment if I'd been called upon to work mm-hmm. for a living in it. I couldn't have done it. But I always had a sneaking suspicion I'd love to do something in terms of Greek and Latin and history.
Mm-hmm.
And Donald, really, he said, well, look, why don't you... I'll teach you it. Mm-hmm. Now, he was only a half a chapter ahead of me, let me tell you.
How many teachers are more than half a chapter ahead of their students?
Well, you're speaking out of experience here, Alan. You could best answer that question. I just loved it.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it. And also God was working in my life. And I must tell you something. One day as I was leaving church, one of the elders was standing at the door. And he made a point in coming over to me. Now, he didn't usually speak in this kind of language, but he came over and he said to me, Russell, have you ever considered the ministry?
Hmm.
I said, Mr. Sterling, never. I have not considered the ministry. And he said, well, I think you should.
Hmm. Why would he have thought that?
He's deceased. I can't point you to him now. I don't know whether it was because he heard me speaking in some other context. He would have noticed that I was now teaching in Bible class. I don't know. I really don't know what John meant by, or where he got that idea from. I didn't press him. Mm-hmm. I know his daughter now, who's a lovely girl, married and goes to the same church as my daughter. But it was he played a significant part in that, because I began to think, not of becoming a Presbyterian minister, because that was outside of my range altogether, but ministry wasn't. Mm-hmm. And while I wasn't sophisticated to know what ministry meant in those days, I did have a desire to increase my knowledge of the scriptures, and I started to look at courses that I might do part-time, one of which was a diploma of theology at London.
London Bible College at the time, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I thought about that. But in the meantime, you know, I was building up contacts and friendships with other Christian people. Mm-hmm. And I went along to my minister to ask him for a reference, because I needed that if I was going to London Bible College. And he said, not at all. No, don't think of that. You should be thinking of going into the ministry, the Presbyterian ministry.
Hmm.
Now, maybe I allowed myself to be directed down that path rather than down the path of London. I'm not sure, you know, one should be at my stage of life certain about all these things, but I'm not awfully sure if that maybe was the best thing. But I followed that advice.
Right.
But the problem was I had left school with one O-level in English language. Yeah. And it must have been a struggle to get that before I came home, because my father had a couple of severe coronaries. Mm. And I was at school in Belfast at this time. So I came back and launched myself into the business.
Mm-hmm. So you had to stop your education?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But I didn't do that with any great grief or mourning, because we weren't a family that was orientated towards education.
Yeah.
It was the shop, your bread and butter, you had to get in. And we all did. My two other brothers, we mucked in there, and I didn't resent that in the slightest. Mm-hmm. And I didn't resent the years that I had to work, that I did work in the shop. They were all formative and interesting, and allowed me to be a person, a people person, give me the range and the opportunities.
Yeah. But the Presbyterian ministry thing, I mean, it's interesting that you say...
You know, we're getting away out of this, Alan, because you give me a sort of an outline, and now we're nowhere in that outline.
We're doing all right.
Some other interesting things to say.
we'll give you a chance to say, by the time we finish these episodes, if there's anything that you haven't had the chance to say and you want to say, we'll give you the chance to do that. But I think it's very interesting that you know, looking back on it, that you would say you still have a little question mark as to whether you took the right decision in terms of the training you followed. Probably very often people are probably going to say, well, you know, it may be difficult looking forward to discern what the right path is, but looking back, probably people do tend to look back often with a bit more sense of, well, I can see how God was guiding. But you still have a question around
that?
Well,
you see, I never had the experience of opening the Bible and having a word, go to Nineveh.
Yes. You'd already tried Tarsus, hadn't you? Tarsus.
Absolutely.
Canadian Tarsus.
You're quite right. You're quite right. But I went by boat, by the way, to Canada.
All right.
And I was very fortunate. I wasn't thrown over. I wonder I didn't fall overboard. But I didn't have that experience that some people have. Although the longer I went on in my Christian life, I discovered that fewer and fewer people had that magic light switch moment when it says you go. No, I actually then started to study at home, and within a year and a half, I had entrance into university, and I did 4 years of doing an arts course, and then I went over to Edinburgh and did theology. But at every stage, I put out a fleece to say, Lord, if this is not what you want me to do, then show me. And the way I wanted him to show me was that I would fail exams and that I would have had to have resits. And if I had to have one resit, I was out. Because at that stage, there were, you know, I could have gone in other directions, but this was the path I had chosen. And Alan, for your own information and for your smile, one of the subjects that I did for O-level was Greek, another was Latin, another was history, the things I wanted to do. And so maybe God in a roundabout way got me onto that path. And then when I went to university, I did Greek and I did history and I did philosophy. And then I did I had the opportunity of doing honours Greek in Edinburgh, and everything in that line was just transformational. Is that what you say?
Yes, yeah. That's the word.
Well, that was it.
But you also enjoyed it, and you were getting to do the things that your heart was really set on.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was so byproducts. Yeah.
That was the byproduct. And but I've always had that wee, not doubting my call, but just doubting, would it have been better to have gone to have done that part-time course?
Yeah.
Maybe not, because I would have been doing it at a distance.
Yeah.
And therefore I would have lacked the fellowship and the warmth and the fun and the excitement that we had in those early days at university. I was a very, very conscientious student. I mean, I worked, because I had to work from 8:30 to 6 and 9 o'clock on a Saturday night when I was in business, I carried out the same practice when I went to university. And whereas these young bloods coming up from school, you know, they were crushing an hour in a day, that was it.
Yeah. I want to pause just for a moment on this whole issue of calling. It's something that it actually came up in a conversation I had with David Dunlop from Windsor Baptist just in a previous episode of the podcast. And it's interesting because he also talked about his lack of a sense of call in the way in which it's often understood. Right. Well, what sort of advice would you give to, you know, a younger person who's saying, I'm not quite sure what to do with my life, I'm kind of interested in some form of ministry, but I'm not sure, how would I know whether God's calling me into it or not? What advice would you give to someone in that position?
Well, you see, just going back to the other thought that we had, if I had had a mentor Fermanagh was not a gospel-greedy county. There weren't very many lively fellowships about. It was hit and miss so often as far as some issues were concerned. That would have eased the burden to have been able to talk it out with someone. But I do feel that if God has is indicating in some way a particular call on your life, the thing I would do is put the brakes on, slow up. Because I think at certain times in a person's life, particularly when they're young, all of this was happening to me when I was 20, 21.
Yeah.
Your one desire is to serve God.
And to do it quickly.
And I do feel that some people end up in Bible college that are ill-prepared for Bible college and leave disillusioned because maybe on the very basic thing, what's next? To go back into their old employment at that stage almost seems to be a failure. So they become confused on it. I would certainly say, don't rush into these things. You know, God has his timing. It's not your time. Yes, you have to push the doors. But I do think that as you wait, it becomes more obvious what he wants you to do. And when that moment comes, then his timing and your timing will coincide and you'll push open and you'll be there.
I think that's tremendously helpful. I do, because I think there can be you know, that sense of, well, you know, we're supposed to be changing the world and we haven't got all day to do it, so let's get on. And it can lead to an impulsiveness and maybe decisions that are half baked.
Yes, and also there is a romantic thing about becoming involved in Christian work.
Oh, yeah.
Now, there are now perhaps it's with the knowledge that I have of all member ministry, the opportunities to serve God. In the office, in the schoolroom, in the wherever you are huge, and people have a far greater awareness of that now than they had in my day. It would just seem if you wanted to be serving Christ, you had to be in something.
You'd be like a minister or a missionary or something
a faith
like
mission
that. Yeah.
Or something like that. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And to go to various places where you're listening to testimonies and of Bible colleges and all the rest, and that's where I want to be.
Yeah.
And they're lovely places to be, but maybe not just for you or for you in his timing, not yours.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You've mentioned mentoring, and you mentioned, I think, the issue of discipling, that you felt that was something could have been done better after your initial decision back at 15. You've also mentioned this idea of a mentor who might come alongside someone and help to discern and to find a sense of leading. Do you want to say anything more about that whole, I mean, we're sort of stepping out of the timeline for a moment here and looking back over a long time in ministry. What would you say about the issue of mentoring?
I think there's a danger here that we're reading in the situation today way back 40, 45, 50 years, in fact. Yeah, I better not go back any further. But
don't give away your age.
Yeah, back many, many years when mentoring was not a word that was known of. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe it was in the dictionary, maybe it wasn't, but nobody spoke about mentoring.
Yeah.
There would be discipling was even a word that wasn't spoken of. It was really, that came out more in the 60s and the 70s. Mm-hmm. I think it was just having Christian friends who took upon themselves that role. Mm-hmm. And you read biographies of John Stott and different people like that, and you realise that they had close friends who did this. And you also come across individuals like William Fry of Dublin, of YMCA fame and CSSM fame, who would have seen themselves in that kind of a role, or T.S. Mooney in Londonderry, who would have followed up individuals and in terms of mission, even writing to people and entering into correspondence. That went on the whole time.
So it was a kind of mentoring without the name?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That went on. Mentoring's not new in that that extent.
Yeah.
But I know when in High Kirk, which is one of the churches I served in, when a person came to Christ, they were allocated a mentor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's somebody to bring them through the next 6 months, maybe a year. And sometimes those mentors for elderly folk would be fellow elderly folk, someone who had matched them in temperament and in gender. And that was a very good thing to do, and it led to lasting results. Mm-hmm. Whereas the time I'm talking about, that wasn't. It was come to the meeting, get saved. Now I'm looking back and I'm realising that was it. And start learning how to swim yourself, you know. And once you sank a few times, maybe they lost interest. They didn't see the bubbles that were rising up out of the water to say that you were still alive, but you were struggling.
Yeah.
Get in there and help.
Yeah.
That didn't take place.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm speaking out of the context of where I lived and the spiritual background and all of that. I think maybe that wasn't the experience of people in larger centres with larger churches and whatnot. I don't know.
Perhaps not. But I think even though, you know, as you say, you're talking about a different, you know, a number of decades ago, you're talking about, you know, in a way imposing things or transposing things that we think about nowadays back into that time.
Yes.
I think nonetheless, the discussion and some of the things that you've mentioned, I think that whole idea of very intentional discipleship and intentional mentoring that you practiced in Highkirk, that's something anybody listening to this who's in church leadership today can look and say, what are we doing in terms of intentional discipleship and intentional mentoring? Were there people around you, were there particular individuals around you who did take an interest? And as you look back, you would say, I'm grateful for the influence of that person in helping me to navigate a particular stage?
I would say not very many.
Mm.
Yes, at school, in that intermediate period between being 15 and 17, there were teachers. I can remember a man called Dick Pope at school who, when we had a rush of enthusiasm, myself and a few other lads and girls, to start a scripture union, you know, really helped us corporately in that regard. But no, I can't think of an awful lot. There were Sunday school teachers in early days who I'm so grateful for, even to this day. One, I shared a birthday, maybe about 40 years between us, but I always was remembered on my birthday by a card. And at CE, the same leader, she took an interest. But, I mean, I grew away from her. I was a growing lad, a young fellow, you know, and I didn't have the like of crusaders to go to. There was nothing for my age group. I'm not sounding like a martyr to the cause. I don't mean to, you know. It was just you're left on your own.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And you were brought to meetings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A car would draw up and we would go off to a meeting. And that was it. There was no structured Bible class or Bible study group that one could be in to learn the very basics.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to McGee, I was asked to join one of two groups, either the Evangelical Union or the SCM.
The Student Christian Movement.
Correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, I didn't know the difference between an evangelical and a liberal.
Mm-hmm.
Those weren't terms that were used.
Mm-hmm.
You were a Christian or you were not a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to go along and find out what was what they are about before I decided where I wanted to hang my cap.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just, in my case, how backward and ignorant I was of the terminology that suddenly I was bombarded with when I went to college. And that made me a very slow joiner.
Right.
Join things and to link up with things. So I wanted to know exactly what this was about.
Was it partially because you didn't want to be labelled?
That was possibly the case, although I was never... that maybe is a wee bit too sophisticated because at that stage I wanted people to know that where I stood. There was no point in messing about here. Maybe later on I didn't want to be labelled as much. You know, because we're very, very prone to do that.
Well, we
particularly
are.
We really are.
We like
here,
it.
Here's you and I talking as dear brothers in Christ with each of us. And we worship in a different place. But, you know, that's pretty revolutionary in many cases. There was a time it wasn't, but that maybe was more a perception than anything else.
Sure. You mentioned McGee, and you'd already mentioned T.S. Mooney.
Yes.
Did he have influence on you at all during your time at McGee?
T.S. didn't.
No.
But that's to my loss.
Mm-hmm.
T.S. did a wonderful job in Londonderry with young men.
Mm-hmm.
No question about that.
Mm-hmm.
And the results of his work are still to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember being in Belfast and meeting a colleague, a young man, who had been passed out. He was an assistant minister. And he came up to me and he said, you know, if you want to get a good church when you come out, get to know T.S. Mooney. Well, you know, that had the opposite effect of me. I determined I didn't want to get to know T.S. Mooney. Mm-hmm. And T.S. was always around, and you know, there always be invitations to go around there. And so I didn't until my virtually my final year, and I got to know T.S. Mm. And I realised I had made a terrible mistake, because he was a man of genuine worth and depth. Mm-hmm. The work that he did amongst the Crusaders, the young men in Londonderry and further afield, only eternity will make known. I was so pleased at the end of the day that T.S. And I got to know each other. Mm-hmm. And also, I was also very pleased that when he was retired, I was asked to speak at his retirement, which was brilliant as far as I was concerned. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you just a wee story about T.S. T.S. invited me to speak at the Londonderry Young People's Convention. I didn't know this was his invitation to meet with me in the Presbyterian hostel, I think, and have lunch. So I had lunch, and T.S., you know, he spoke in this little voice, and he said, I've got a proposition to put to you. And the proposition was that I would come and speak at the Young People's Convention in Londonderry. And I said, no, T.S., thank you very much for asking me, but I couldn't. Why can't you? Well, I said, first of all, it's not a Young People's Convention. It's all middle-aged people that come along, and they're all Christians. And I would have nothing to say to them. I was in Newry at the time. Oh, he says, that's not right. I said, it is. And I said, if it was, there'd have to be huge changes before I would come. And I know you know a lot of people, so you've no problem getting a speaker, but it'll not be me. Next year, T.S. contacted me. He said, look, I want to talk to you again. So I went and talked to T.S. And he said, well, what about coming and speaking at the... I said, look, T.S., you know my form here. And he said, OK, what changes do you want? So I said, well, I want a group of young people to plan this convention. I wanted the format to be changed. I want the objectives to be changed. I would suggest to you that for at least 1 year you make it an evangelistic outreach to young people in the Waterside district of Derry. And he hemmed and he had, and he said, and here's the bigness of the man, all right, we'll do that. And he handed it over, because that was the big thing. He had to hand it over. Mm-hmm. It was his pigeon for so many years, and much blessed. Mm-hmm. He handed it over to a group of his young disciples, and they planned it, and they had, I think it was called The Place, and they transformed the bottom of, I think it was a Methodist church in Waterside. And I went along with a team, because I was very much under the influence of the David Watson School of Evangelism.
We'll have to come back to David Watson
next
time.
Oh, you can't leave him.
Yeah.
And we came back, and we formed a team. We went up for a week from High Kirk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was great. And there are people in the kingdom today, I'm very happy to say, because of that, that week. And T.S.'s willingness to change. Mm-hmm. And to allow outsiders to be the change agents. And then, of course, the next year they got back. Oh, no, the next year they had asked the chap from America, Baptist preacher, Alan, you should know him.
You're thinking Alistair Begg?
I'm thinking of Alistair Begg. Alistair was very popular as far as the Young People's Convention. Mm-hmm. But he couldn't come for the first two nights, I think, and I was brought along very much the second choice to do that on a teaching mission this time. And Alistair came for the following few years, I think. So
that's great. I think we're going to close it there for this particular episode. But lots to think about there, and I think even just that example of T.S. Mooney, a very very strong character, yet the willingness to be challenged in what he was doing, to be open to change, and as you say, even change that would be handed over to people from the outside.
And when T.S. died, I grieved. Mm. And I really only had the benefit at Mickey of maybe a year and a half of knowing him. Mm-hmm. And the chap who made that remark to me in Belfast did me, and I think the kingdom, a great disservice. Yeah. But with T.S. Mooney and Alan Flavell, you know, we had... I'm not saying there aren't people like that today, because there are, but those two were formidable men as far as the kingdom of God was concerned.
Great. Well, listen, we haven't even got you... we've alluded to church ministry, but we haven't really even got you into church ministry yet, so...
Or
come back again, or leadership. We've still got lots to cover. But thanks for talking to us, and look forward to talking a little bit more next time.
Thank you, Alan.
Thanks for listening to the Leadership Journey podcast, and thanks to Russell for taking the time to talk to us. Remember to subscribe to the podcast, and remember also, if you are interested in the upcoming Leaders Retreat, you can visit the CleoPass website and find out information about how you can register for that. Russell will be back with us again next week, so make sure that you join us for the second part of our conversation. And in the meantime, have a good week.